At what point does escalation become overreach? On the October 8th one-year anniversary of the first Hezbollah rockets fired on Israel, the IDF announcing the killing of another top-ranking Hezbollah commander, the heir apparent to Hassan Nasrallah, and the deployment of a 4th Division to southern Lebanon. Militarily, the Israelis have been wildly successful the past 2 weeks, neutralizing much of the enemy's leadership, cashing in on years of painstaking intelligence work. But what's the precise objective of it all? After flattening Gaza for a year, Israel's already forced an estimated 1.2 million Lebanese to flee their homes. To what end? Israelis employ the adage that to make peace, you first need war. We'll ask our panel if that makes sense as the world waits for Israel's response to direct rocket attacks by Hezbollah patron Iran. And does this escalation serve the interest of Israel's allies? Starting with the United States, where talk of brokering a truce alongside France has gone quiet. Is Biden or Netanyahu driving the policy these days in Washington? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking about an escalation towards what ends. With us from Beirut, France 24 correspondent Rawad Taha. Thanks for being with us.
Good evening.
From Tel Aviv, columnist, former ambassador to the United States, Alan Pincus. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be with you. I was consul general in New York.
Consul general. Thank you for the correction. From Norman.
Much prouder of that, by the way.
Consul general. Okay. From Norman, Oklahoma, Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the minder of the blog SyriaComment.com. Great to see you, Joshua.
Pleasure.
And France 24's Philip Turl is with us here in the studio. How are things? Your reactions have been coming in on the hashtag F24Debate. Let's start with the latest. He was the potential successor to Hassan Nasrallah, Israel's prime minister himself, announcing the killing of Hashem Safieddine. This on the day when his military announced more ground forces for a widening conflict. Camille Knight has more on that.
Israel is stepping up its invasion of southern Lebanon. The IDF says it's expanding its operation by sending more troops into the southwest of the country. Until now, its invasion had focused on the eastern side of the border. It's a follow-up to Monday's evacuation orders, which included more than 20 villages south of Tyre. Evacuees were told to head north of the Awali River and to stay off beaches and out of the sea across a 60-kilometer stretch. Further north, Israel continues to bombard southern Beirut, with smoke rising over buildings on Tuesday after at least 10 airstrikes were carried out there overnight. Israel's defense minister says Hezbollah is now weaker than ever.
When I look at the picture, Hezbollah is an organization without a head. Nasrallah was eliminated. His replacement was also probably eliminated. All the top leaders as well. This has a dramatic effect on everything that happens. There is no one to make decisions, no one to act.
His comments come just hours after Hezbollah's top official delivered a speech publicly endorsing ceasefire negotiations for the very first time, but also emphasizing Hezbollah's readiness to continue the fight.
I would like to reassure you, our capabilities are fine, and what the enemy said about our capabilities being affected is a delusion. The party's leadership and the resistance are perfectly organized.
On Tuesday, Hezbollah launched more than 100 rockets towards Haifa and the wider region in the north of Israel, most of which were intercepted. It's the country's third largest city and was hit on Monday for the first time in 2 decades.
Alan Pincus, to put it bluntly, what's next?
To put it bluntly, I don't know. To be honest, look, this is a spiraling escalation, and probably the first immutable law of escalation is that when you think you control it, you don't. And everyone who claims that they control escalation, that they know exactly what to do to avoid a retaliatory strike on the other side, which is the definition of escalation, is talking nonsense. You can't. And now that puts us today where Israel is vowing to retaliate against Iran's launching of 181 missiles, ballistic missiles, last week. And on a different or in a different arena, a different theater, Israel is expanding what it called, again, nonsensically, a limited ground operation in southern Lebanon. It's not limited. It could prove to be limited in terms of duration, but it's not limited. Now, these are two supposedly linked, but they're not really linked theaters in terms of the political goals, because in Lebanon, there are no political goals. With Iran, supposedly, there are. In Gaza, there should have been. But what you see right now is Israel fighting in three fronts, conceivably maybe even four, if you include the simmering violence in the West Bank, without any political objective in mind.
When you say in Lebanon there are no political goals, what do you mean?
I mean that Hezbollah is not the sovereign government of Lebanon. Hezbollah is a state within a state that took Lebanon hostage, that made a gross miscalculation by joining the war on October 8th, as you accurately said in your opening lines. In fact, Hassan Nasrallah on the 8th said, this is not our war. Something that was then echoed by the Iranians. This is not our war. And there was no reason for Hezbollah, which have legitimate claims in terms of the demarcation of the Israeli-Lebanese border, but then again, they are not the government of Lebanon. But let's assume it's legitimate. These are legitimate claims. Why did they join the war? Okay, so a show of solidarity, that's fine. A projection of power and credibility, that's acceptable. That's not crossing the implicit or tacit red lines. But then they upped the ante and made it untenable and intolerable for Israel. And what you see and what I see in the background in the footage that you're showing right now is the result of that miscalculation. Now, one more thing, if I may. There's no political end, because what are you going to do after you bomb the next town, you bomb the next hill, you take over the next creek, you kill five more Hezbollah military or political leaders? Okay, what then? Do you withdraw back to the international border? Probably, hopefully, but then that illustrates or that proves that there was no political goal here, because there's no one to negotiate with in Lebanon. Iran and the Palestinians, completely different opera.
And you talk about nobody to negotiate with. Again, we're speaking on the day when the Prime Minister of Israel has just announced the death of Hezbollah's heir apparent. Benjamin Netanyahu issued a stark warning to the Lebanese people. Let's listen.
Stand up and take your country back. You have an opportunity that hasn't existed in decades. An opportunity to take care of the future of your children and grandchildren. You have an opportunity to save Lebanon before it falls into the abyss of a long war that will lead to destruction and suffering like we see in Gaza.
Destruction and suffering like we see in Gaza. Any reactions yet where you are, Rawad Taha? Rawad, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, any reactions where you are?
No reactions whatsoever to the statement by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu regarding this message to the Lebanese people. Also important is the fact that he claimed in that message that the assassination of Nasrallah's successor, potentially he is referring to Hashem Safiyuddin, has also been successful. Still no confirmation on that end as well from Lebanese officials or from Hezbollah itself. In terms of the words in that statement, this is a very controversial statement. So Netanyahu here is putting the blame on the Lebanese people at a time of war, at a time when 1.2 million people are internally displaced, at a time where Hezbollah's positions regarding internal affairs are not clear enough. Now, just to remind our viewers, yes, Hezbollah is a state within a state, but Hezbollah has a clear representation in Lebanese parliament. During the last elections, they have had at least 300,000 votes, more than 13 MPs within parliament. So What Netanyahu is trying to address the Lebanese is definitely not plausible anytime in the near future. This could actually lead to a lot of internal civil unrest, and I don't think any Lebanese political party has enough power and enough legitimacy today to actually turn the table over Hezbollah whatsoever during such a critical phase. In fact, what we saw during the past few days is a moment of national solidarity and unity, especially after the start of the ground invasion. So we've seen that the entire political landscape over the past few years has been described as a severely polarized political landscape, especially regarding the issue of Hezbollah and its weapons. But during such an instance where Israeli boots are on the ground in southern Lebanon, turning the tables against Hezbollah could be a very hard task. We've only seen one statement from the opposition over the past few days, signed by the opposition and a number of dominant political parties, most notably the Lebanese Forces and the Lebanese Kataib and a few independent MPs, calling for the implementation of the 1701 resolution and the implementation of the 1559 resolution, which calls on all armed groups in Lebanon to disarm, as well as calling for international observer forces along the border with Syria in the north and in the east. But no one whatsoever actually put forward any sort of a next page where there is peace on the table between Lebanon and Israel. And no one is ready to take this confrontation with Hezbollah to the next level. So I don't think there is any reactions expected to that statement in the near moment from any Lebanese official.
Yeah, we saw earlier it was the British news agency putting a dispatch out, Rawad, after Hezbollah's deputy leader, and we saw a clip of him in that report at the outset, Naim Qassem, made a statement underlining the fact that what he did not say, and it was the first time that he did not mention the end of war in Gaza as a precondition for a truce. Off the record, are they ready for a truce on the Lebanese side, and especially Hezbollah?
Indeed, this was the first time Hezbollah announced officially since the start of this war of attrition exactly 1 year ago on October 8th of 2023 that it is ready to discuss a ceasefire in Lebanon while disregarding what is happening in Gaza. Now, we know for a fact, just to remind our viewers, that Nasrallah and Hezbollah started this war of attrition on October 8th, a day after Hamas started its attack on Israel and after Israel started its war on Hamas in Gaza as well. So it was a war of attrition, a limited war of attrition near the border between southern Lebanon and northern Israel. But it was not a full-scale war such as what we've been experiencing over the past 2 weeks. Yes, this was the first time a Hezbollah official that announced that the party is ready to possibly de-link the negotiations on Lebanon from the negotiations on Gaza and is seeking a ceasefire here in Lebanon first. However, what he also mentioned is that the party is ready to address other issues after that ceasefire is achieved. What he meant by that statement is the fact that there is a lot of international pressure, especially coming from the U.S. and other Western powers, calling on the Lebanese first and the Lebanese parliament in particular and the Speaker of Parliament to conduct a session for parliament, to elect a president, to form a government, and then negotiate a ceasefire deal with Israel. So this is pressuring Hezbollah to accept different terms of what it had been trying to achieve over the past 2 years of the presidential vacuum. Now, we know that Hezbollah has been trying to push forward the candidacy of its ally, Sulaiman Franji, to the presidency. That has been blocked in parliament. Hezbollah wasn't able to secure a majority for its presidential nominee, and thus there was a presidential vacuum for the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. Now there is a lot of pressure. The U.S. is trying to seek this opportunity to push for the election of a president first, and then the formation of a government, and then potential talks on ceasefire. Now, Hezbollah is saying that it is ready to discuss a ceasefire, but only a ceasefire, and everything else comes after that.
Joshua Landis, before let me ask you first of all, because if you look at the long arc of Hezbollah's existence, its rise, the and its prominence now with all this senior leadership that's been either killed or maimed in the last 2 weeks, when there's this talk of a truce, is it Hezbollah speaking, or is that a statement that's vetted by Iran?
Well, Hezbollah and Iran work hand in glove, and the two have to agree on these things. So I don't think that you can really distinguish between the two. There is an alliance, and the two depend on each other completely. So they have to agree on that. But, you know, I was sitting in Damascus in 1982 when Israel first invaded Lebanon and watched the Iranian troops move in and so forth. And the Shia were largely welcomed, the Israelis, because they were being liberated from the PLO, which had ruled them over the south of Lebanon for decades. And that quickly turned to resistance because the Israelis, of course, remained in Lebanon. They had political objectives, which was to create a pro-Israeli, pro-American government run by Pierre Jamayel in Lebanon. And that ended up in tears because Jamayel was assassinated. The government never formed, and Lebanon remained in ruins. And Hezbollah grew up to fight quite effectively the Israelis. Now, if the Israelis remain on the ground, they're going to be met by resistance. Hezbollah will re-establish itself and re-establish a leadership and begin to fight. And that's the danger that Israel faces. Israel does not have military objectives here that are political objectives that can clear this up, because it continues to occupy Palestinian land in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, the Golan Heights of Syria. It doesn't have a solution for this. And as long as it doesn't provide the Palestinians with self-determination, some degree of justice, there's going to be resistance. And there's going to be resistance from the region as well if it continues to keep its troops on other people's land. And this is a problem. Israel can mow the lawn, as it's doing now, and that's what Israeli officials often refer to it as. But lawns grow back. And there isn't a real answer to Israel's problems as long as it just seeks to have a military solution. Ultimately, it's going to have to negotiate. And I know it doesn't want to negotiate with Hezbollah. And that's the point here. It wants to only negotiate with the Lebanese government. But that's a myth, in the same way that it doesn't want to negotiate with Palestinians.
But is this, Joshua, an unprecedented situation that we're in? We've seen multiple countries attack Israel in 48, in 67, in 73. But is this unprecedented, what we're witnessing?
You know, it isn't unprecedented. It is a show of Israeli power, which is really quite striking. Israel is technologically far superior to its neighbors, and it's showing us this once again, just in the way it did in 1967 when it attacked both Egypt, Jordan, and Syria by surprise, and it was able to increase its landmass by 300%. But the problem with that kind of dominance is that Israel doesn't go back to its borders. Instead, it continues to expand. And that expansion itself creates new resistance, as it did in 67. And it's still fighting, as we heard, in the West Bank. And it's going to turn the West Bank into Gaza, which it's doing very rapidly. It's pushing Palestinians out of their towns, taking their property, and making it impossible for a two-state solution. And that means that the Palestinians in West Bank will begin to fight, just as they did in Gaza. And it's an endless cycle of violence until there are real negotiations.
Alan Pincus, when the week began, there's, of course, another variable in all of this, which is for the very first time, you have first in the month of April, and then exactly a week ago, direct confrontation between Israel and Iran. And it was billed to us that we'd be seeing Israel's defense minister in Washington to confer with the Biden administration. Do we have any news of that?
Well, he may not go. There was a news report about an hour ago that said, that reported that the prime minister said that his trip to Washington is contingent on the cabinet making binding decisions, and only after he, the prime minister, speaks to Biden. And that suggests that Netanyahu prefers that he not go, because if he does attack Iran and things go bad, and things go wrong, or things are less than successful, then he has someone to blame, as he always does. Now, let's assume he does go, okay? I think that the gist of the conversation is going to be the Americans trying to pressure, something that they haven't done in the last year, and when they did do it, it was unsuccessful, and they, by and large, refrain from using levers of pressure and power. But let's assume that this time they mean more business, because this time the stakes are much higher, a full-blown war that could, under some scenarios, drag the U.S. in. So I think what the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who I see in the background here, is going to be told in Washington by his counterpart, Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary, is one thing. Do not attack Iran's nuclear facilities and infrastructure, and do not attack Iran's oil infrastructure and facilities. You're free to have a go at Iranian military targets or the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And even that should be proportionate. But here's the catch. There is a possibility in the Israeli calculus of Mr. Netanyahu right now, who I'm afraid to say is somewhat messianic and megalomaniac.
Messianic?
Yes. His entire, I will reconfigure the Middle East. I will free the Iranian people. He said that, if you will, the Iranian people will be free. And this thing that you showed, this footage that you showed a few moments ago, him calling on the Lebanese people, I mean, who does he think he is? We're a year away from the worst calamity and debacle in Israel's history, something that he, until now, one year and one day ago, did not take responsibility and did not assume responsibility. But he has developed an alternative narrative, that this was not about a Hamas attack on October 7th, but rather this is a civilizational war, the epicenter of which is the Iranian Islamofascism, and he, Benjamin the Crusader Netanyahu, is defending the West. Now, yes, that's messianic. Now, back to the policy issue. Even given American warnings and even given Israeli technological limitations of effectively attacking Iran's nuclear facilities, Mr. Netanyahu could conclude, not without logic, by the way, that the confluence of circumstances is such that this is the time to do something, even if it's less, even if the result is less than ultimate success. And so that trip that Mr. Gallant may or may not go on in Washington could be an exercise in futility in terms of America trying to avert escalation.
Well, it's time for us to bring in the French element to all of this. France's new foreign minister was in Israel on October 7th for commemorations, this before meeting the Palestinian prime minister. However, there were no joint photo ops with Jean-Noël Barrot's Israeli counterpart, Israel Katz, and the Israeli strategic affairs minister, Ron Dermer, not after the row sparked by the French president dangling the threat late last week of an arms embargo on Israel.
If we are calling for a ceasefire, consistency means not supplying arms for war. Those who provide arms cannot simultaneously call for a ceasefire and continue to supply them.
As Israel fights the forces of barbarism led by Iran, all civilized countries should be standing firmly by Israel's side. Yet President Macron and some other Western leaders are now calling for an arms embargo against Israel. Shame on them.
Now the question, Philip Turrell, is whether Macron's remarks were directed about, you know, this sort of veiled threat of an arms embargo, not so veiled, perhaps. Is it directed at Israel or the United States? CNN quoting unnamed U.S. officials is saying Washington is not actively trying to revive. Remember that truce deal, 21 days between that was during UN week. We talked about it. France and the United States were trying to broker between Lebanon and Israel.
Well, I think there is growing frustration on the part of the international community to a great extent with the lack of progress in trying to draw up a ceasefire in certainly the Gaza Strip and now in southern Lebanon. And I think many in the international community are really looking at this saying, we don't seem to have much power to do anything. Benjamin Netanyahu appears to be doing exactly what he wants. He's not listening to the United States. We're in a power vacuum because Joe Biden is coming to the end of his presidency. Benjamin Netanyahu wants to get as much done in this month gap between the end of the Biden presidency and maybe a return to the White House of Donald Trump or Kamala Harris being elected to succeed Joe Biden. But whatever happens, he has got a window of opportunity to get things done right now. And whatever the international community wants, whatever they're calling for, he's not going to take any notice.
But are the French angry at Israel or are the French angry at the United States?
I think there is a bit of both. I think the French are angry with the United States because they feel that Joe Biden over the last year has really not been strict enough with Benjamin Netanyahu. We've heard time and time again the same words coming out of the mouth of Joe Biden that the United States will always support Israel. Israel has a right to defend itself, and those weapons and that military support will keep coming. And also, I think there's frustration with the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu, who went to the UN General Assembly a couple of weeks ago and was off the cuff reported to be saying that he was in agreement with a ceasefire deal with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon so that that would not lead to the threat of a much wider conflict, then did an about turn when he went to the Tribune saying he was going to carry on with this limited incursion into southern Lebanon, which nobody really knows what that means in the long run. So there's frustration with the United States not being stronger with their stance towards Benjamin Netanyahu, and frustration with the Israeli leadership that it really doesn't appear to be listening to anybody, least of all France. The big problem, Francois, is this, is that France doesn't have much leverage because France doesn't really supply very much in the way of weapons to the Israelis. Only 30 million euros worth of weapons going in a year compared to 3.8 billion for the United States. So it's really a drop in a bucket, if you like, for the Israelis. But symbolically, this is quite an important move because I think what Israel is fearing is that what President Macron has said may have a knock-on effect with other countries to say, well, if France is going to make that statement and take that position, then maybe we should as well, because that will sack the pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu to try to reach a ceasefire deal to bring this conflict to a standstill.
All right, France's reasoning not flying with a couple of Capitol Hill heavyweights, it seems. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham in Israel, in the company of his Democratic counterpart, Richard Blumenthal. And there you see him in the middle, Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Graham taking more than just a passing shot at Emmanuel Macron.
To my friends in France, you got this ass backwards. You should be doubling down on helping Israel because the people that want to destroy Israel also want to destroy the French people.
Joshua Landis, your thoughts on the message sent there by the senator from South Carolina?
Well, you know, it's easy to think that America is not halting arms shipments to Israel because Biden is a lame duck, but that's far from true. Biden has the power to help Israel or stop supplying arms to Israel, even though he's a lame duck. The real problem here is that we're in the middle of an election cycle in the United States, and the pro-Israeli support for both presidential candidates is very important, and particularly the financial support. And this leads both presidents to be in a scramble to outbid each other for being pro-Israeli. And we just heard Trump come out the other day and say, in response to Biden, who said, please don't attack Iran's nuclear capability, Trump came out and said, oh, that's terrible. Do attack it. You need to attack it and then worry about whatever happens next. And this is the kind of cycle we're in right now as elections. We lead up to elections in November.
It's not as simple as Republicans versus Democrats. We had that CNN report, which quoted unnamed U.S. officials as saying Washington's not actively trying to revive the truce deal. Politico last week publishing a story that also quoted unnamed sources that were pointing to a White House meeting a week ago Monday. Behind the scenes, the main architects, Emmis Hochstein, Brett McGurk, and other top U.S. national security officials describing Israel's Lebanon operations as a history-defining moment, one that will reshape the Middle East for better years to come. There has been some dissent in that same article, says Politico, but most senior White House officials agree that the conflict, while fragile, could offer an opportunity to reduce Iran's influence in Lebanon and the region. Joshua Landis, these are not Republicans. These are Democrats.
Yes, they are. And they're both parties are outbidding each other. They are, you know, this Biden has called himself a dyed-in-the-wool Zionist, and he is going to give Israel the bear hug, as he said, that by being close to Israel, they will stick together and there will be no light between them. And this is now, obviously, Washington is trying to throw in some of their own advice, but Netanyahu has not taken their advice. And at each step of the way, Biden has embraced whatever Netanyahu has done, because frankly, it's very important for the Democrats to continue supporting Israel. And that's the way it is in the United States. And it doesn't matter what Macron says or other European powers say. This is an internal domestic issue. America is attached to Israel by the hip, and it's not going to separate. They, both candidates have made it extremely clear that they're on the side of Israel, no matter what kind of escalation goes on.
Alan Pincus, it's Netanyahu can decide whatever he wants.
Well, look, I agree with everything that Joshua Landis said. I'll try and add add some perspective here. No, they're not. In fact, if you look at the quotes coming out of Bob Woodward's new book titled War, describing Biden's relations with, amongst other leaders, Netanyahu, Putin, and several others, there are a lot of expletives, a lot of profanities, a lot of expressions of disappointment, distrust. Look, Netanyahu, as far as the Americans are concerned, Netanyahu deceived them, manipulated them, lied to them outrightly. You just mentioned the 21-day ceasefire that supposedly Netanyahu agreed to and briefed everyone that he's contemplating, while at the same time making plans for a war. The same applies to several attempts at a hostage deal and a ceasefire and a concomitant ceasefire in Gaza. That hasn't happened. But the striking thing about all this is that while the administration is upset with Netanyahu, the administration dislikes Netanyahu. The administration has no trust in Netanyahu, and he has lost. He suffers from an acute credibility deficit in Washington. However, that was never translated into policy. All you got was Blinken saying he's concerned, Secretary of State Blinken saying he's concerned, or sending the Matthew Miller, the State Department spokesman, to mumble something about the U.S. is looking at this with utmost care. And all these, you know, insignificant, say-nothing cliches. And so when you look at the big picture, there is truth to the premise of your remark that, yeah, that Netanyahu is making that the policies that Netanyahu wants or the things that Netanyahu wants done, the Americans, however grudgingly, end up agreeing with.
Is it grudgingly, Joshua Landis? Because you mentioned earlier in our conversation how you remember 1982. A lot of decision makers in Washington remember 1983 when there was the Hezbollah attack on U.S. installations in Beirut. 283 killed French and American soldiers. And that is stuck in a lot of people's brains in Washington ever since. Does that, in a way, give Netanyahu a free pass?
Well, it gives him a free pass in the sense that both candidates, whether they disagree, they see him as untrustworthy and so forth, they have hitched their wagon to this because of the elections. It really is about the elections and American domestic politics. And it's a runaway train, and they're going to follow it wherever it goes. And this puts Prime Minister Netanyahu, as you said, in the driver's seat. And he has become extraordinarily self-confident. It was when he went to Congress just recently and got 55 standing ovations, more than presidents get. He can do an end run around the president, as he did and with Obama when he went to Congress and Obama's holding the stop settlements. He made Obama look like a joke on the Israeli issue. And Obama had to suck it up and sort of nod his head, because he has broad support in America, in the American Congress and in American elected officials. And he knows that he doesn't have to listen to the president. The president is going to come along with him wherever he goes. And that seems to be the case in Iran. And that's why the situation, I think, has become so fraught, because we don't know what kind of escalation could go on. And his self-confidence and what we heard, just now about him being messianic, I think frightens many people. But
Yeah, I was going to say, Joshua Landis, you're echoing what Alan Pincus said at the beginning. It's very difficult to manage an escalation. Let's listen to Iran, their reaction, the regime. They say they're waiting for Israel's response to last week's direct a salvo of missiles, insisting that it won't change a thing to coming for its support for the likes of Hezbollah.
Iran's policy is to support the resistance. This is a fundamental policy that has existed in the past and exists now, and will in no way violate this policy. If any negotiations happen, it's for stopping the crimes and condemning the Zionist regime, and to counter the attempts by this regime to expand the war in the region.
Rawat, is that just the standard speak, Iran's regime on message? Or is there a particular message that we should glean from what we just heard in that clip?
So the foreign minister was here in Beirut a few days ago, and we saw a shift in narrative among Lebanese officials shortly after his visit. In particular, before his visit and after the last round of escalations, we saw a meeting between the caretaker prime minister, Najib Mikati, along with the Speaker of Parliament, Nabih Birri, who is also head of the Amal movement, a key ally to Hezbollah, as well as the former leader of the Progressive Socialist Party, Walid Jumblat, who is considered the political leader of the Druze community here in Lebanon. Their unified stance before the arrival of the foreign minister was that the state of Lebanon is seeking an immediate ceasefire as soon as possible, and that this initiative and this collective meeting between the three of them was going to be expanded to reach significant other groups and other political actors and parties. However, we saw that the visit of the foreign minister into Beirut, where he met with Prime Minister Mikati and other leaders and officials, and the call by the foreign minister for the Lebanese people was that for them to resist and to hold their ground. So potentially signaling that you should not speak about a ceasefire just yet and keep the fight going. That was the message that was explicitly said, at least to the public and to the media here in Beirut. And there was frustration from a number of politicians from the way that message was conveyed. Yet we're hearing today from the deputy of Nasrallah, Sheikh Naim Qasim, who also mentioned that Hezbollah is ready for a ceasefire. So we're seeing two different messages conveyed over the past 2 days. A message by the foreign minister calling on the Lebanese people and Hezbollah supporters to hold their ground. And yet we're seeing a message from the deputy speaker of the deputy secretary general of Hezbollah calling for that the party is ready for a ceasefire. However, one thing to also mention that we didn't discuss yet is the situation on the ground regarding this ground invasion and the ongoing conflict and the incursions. So up until this moment, the situation is still unclear of what's going on in the ground. There seems to have been some sort of a limited Israeli incursions into a number of towns. But I just spoke with the UNIFIL spokesperson here in Lebanon, Andrea Tenenti, who told me that the situation is unclear. It is unsafe. They cannot know the reality of what's going on, but there isn't any mass movements of Israeli troops into Lebanese territory just yet. We saw some limited incursions into a number of villages in the eastern side of the border near the town of Kfar Kila a few days ago, but then the Israelis retreated. We saw some incursions near the town of Marun al-Ras yesterday, but then the Israelis also retreated. We've seen confrontation between both sides of the conflict near the western part of southern Lebanon, near the Mediterranean Sea today, and it's still unclear who's holding the ground. So it seems that even with the fact that Hezbollah is in disarray, even with the assassination of its senior commanders and its entire leadership, those on the ground are still holding their ground at least till this moment. Or it's still not clear whether Israel has started its larger campaign in terms of scope and number of soldiers and movement into Lebanese territory. But from what we're hearing and what is confirmed by UNIFIL on the ground, that it's still only limited incursions. So even if Hezbollah is in complete disarray, it seems that it is still holding its ground in certain areas in the southern part of Lebanon.
Which brings us back to what we discussed at the outset, Alan Pincus. Israel going in 48 hours from two divisions to four inside of Lebanon. Does that suggest that it's going to be more than just trying to take out missile sites and tunnels?
The question is not just the duration of this, but also whether or not on our way out, on its way out, will Israel carve a security zone? We've done that for many years. We've hemorrhaged. We've become sitting ducks. It did not produce any viable and enduring achievements. And if Israel gets out and says, because we cannot tolerate Hezbollah trickling back into those villages within firing range of Israeli towns, villages, and agricultural settlements on the border, we have to stay, we have to maintain a line of defense, then the whole idea, the whole concept of a limited incursion becomes meaningless. And that remains to be seen, because there are two threats that Israel, military, there are two threats that Israel sees here. One is the long-range ballistic missiles, to which they land, to which a ground operation is no redress. And the second is a Hezbollah entrenchment along the border, which is what we've seen in the last year or so, that made this so untenable and so unbearable that Israel felt the need to go in. However, given what's going on in Gaza, given what's brewing in the West Bank, and given what's going on in Iran, I doubt that Israel will stay in Lebanon.
Doubted for now. Joshua Landis, again, it's happening on so many fronts. While we've been on air, war monitors from inside of Syria saying that a building was targeted in Damascus in an airstrike. We presume that it is Israel. Four killed in that one. It's spiraling, and what, it's going to keep running?
Indeed. Syria, Israel has been bombing Syria usually about twice a week over the last, certainly since October 7th, but over the last few years, it has picked up the pace since October 7th because Syria serves as a conduit between Iran and Hezbollah. And that means that Israel has been attacking Syria, in a really quite a drumbeat of attacks. It just went after a big missile building center in Masyaf, which is on the coast area, and commandos landed, went in, got computers out, killed the people that were there. This has been an ongoing process. So Syria is very much part of this front. Once Iran gets entered into this, we don't know where things could go. Mm. The Iranians have said, if you attack our oil, we're going to attack Saudi Arabia's oil. We're going to close off the Persian Gulf. So whether they will really do that or not is anybody's guess. But things could go sideways pretty quickly.
Joshua Landis, I want to thank you so much for joining us from Norman, Oklahoma. I want to thank Alan Pincus for being with us from Tel Aviv. Our correspondent, Rawad Taha, in Beirut. France 24's Philip Turrell. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.